At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First things first, forget everything you ever knew about TARP. The government's plan to bail out the banks is now officially called the Financial Stability Plan. And not only is the Obama administration rebranding the rescue, but the price tag is going up too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's the 10th of February. It's Tuesday, and of course, it's great to have you here. Now that we've got our nomenclature right, it's worth spending some time laying out exactly what the Financial Stability Plan is, because mostly what it is a delicate and political balance between not going too easy on the banks that got us into this mess and making sure everybody knows the Obama administration is serious about fixing it. Reviews of what's already being called the Geithner Plan were mixed today, starting with one of its key features, trying to triage which banks are the worst off. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale gets us going today.
To diagnose the financial disease, Secretary Geithner borrowed a medical term. Large banks will be subjected to a stress test to figure out which ones have the resources to survive a punishing economy.
To do this, we're going to bring together the agencies with authority over our nation's banks and initiate a more consistent, realistic, forward-looking assessment about the exposures on bank balance sheets, and we're going to introduce new measures to improve disclosure.
Once banks have gone through the stress test, they become eligible for government assistance, called a capital buffer, to help them offer loans and credit during the economic downturn. What happens to banks that fail the test? Wayne Abernathy with the American Bankers Association says this isn't like school.
Stress tests are not pass-fail tests. Stress tests, much like a health exam that you might have at the doctor. You go to the doctor and he says, well, you know, let me tell you, you've got a little bit too much cholesterol here, but your heart rate is good, and I think maybe here you want to be a little careful about salt. The purpose of the stress test is to find out where the weaknesses are.
In cases where the test reveals a lot of weaknesses, banks will be subjected to more regulatory scrutiny, says Ward McCarthy of Stone & McCarthy Research.
They'll find themselves in a situation where the government is increasingly involved in their activities until they are solvent enough or strong enough to, again, be set free.
Not quite nationalizing the banks, he says, but a step in that direction. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The program to revive the banking industry had less than $350 billion left in it when Tim Geithner walked up to the podium today. And then, barely without even blinking, the Treasury Secretary outlined $1.5 trillion, or maybe $2 trillion worth of new spending. So, where's all that cash going to come from? As he said today, Geithner is clearly hoping to get private investors to cough up hundreds of billions of dollars to buy up some troubled assets. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports up to $1 trillion more will come from the Federal Reserve.
So where will the Fed get $1 trillion to pay for its piece of the bailout?
There are basically two options.
James Hamilton's an economist who follows the Fed closely.
One is to have the Treasury borrow the money and keep it in an account for the Fed to use.
Or the Fed could get the money from commercial banks. Right now, banks have nearly $650 billion stashed at the Federal Reserve. They're afraid to lend.
Right. As long as the banks just sit on those reserves, the Fed can use those funds without any repercussions.
But if banks decide to do something else with all that money, the Fed will need to cover the shortfall quickly. It could just print money, but Catherine Mann at Brandeis says that would create a new set of problems.
Then ultimately, that is inflationary.
Mann says inflation is a long way off, but she agrees with Hamilton that taxpayers and the general public are the ones on the hook here. And that makes Hamilton a bit queasy.
I don't like those kind of huge commitments on the taxpayers being made in kind of secretive backroom deals. I don't think that's healthy for our system.
And Beverly Lumpkin at the Project on Government Oversight says that's just the trouble.
The Fed is just about the most opaque organization in Washington, D.C.
If the federal government's going to spend more than $1 trillion propping up the financial system, Hamilton says Congress should have to vote to appropriate the money. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Geithner made a lot of promises about transparency today, about disclosure. And he said the government's setting up a new website to let the public know who's getting government money and how they're using it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Treasury Secretary Geithner says the new website, financialstability.gov, will show whether federal money is actually increasing lending.
The American people will be able to see where their tax dollars are going and the return on their government's investment.
The Treasury Department already requires monthly reports from some banks that get government cash. They have to disclose loan information and purchases of some securities. But some critics say Treasury is just trying to placate taxpayers.
Transparency is kind of like a magic elixir, and it's something that people talk about but nobody drinks.
Robert Bruska is chief economist for Fact and Opinion Economics. He says it's really hard to track how banks spend taxpayer dollars, even if banks say they're sequestering the money in a special account.
You're going to be watching religiously things in this one account where the banks want you to look, and you're not going to look at other things. No, you want to look at everything that they do.
But some regulators say banks might be skittish about asking for emergency help if they knew the public would find out. And there are concerns that Geithner's new transparency rules could be a little too revealing, undermining public faith in banks and their stock. On the other hand,
we already have a great deal of stock market volatility. We already have very low share prices for these companies.
That's James Ellman, president of Seacliff Capital in San Francisco.
So I doubt that more transparency would make the situation worse. I think it will make it better.
And Ellman says the government shouldn't hesitate to take over weak banks. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I'm not a big believer in karma or anything, but there was a certain synchronicity between the markets and real life today that was tough to miss. The day that President-elect Obama nominated Tim Geithner to run Treasury, the Dow rose 494 points, topped 8,000 that day. On the day the secretary announced his financial rescue plan, that would be today, the blue chips gave up 381, broke 8,000 on the way down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tough as it may be for Wall Street to swallow this, times have changed. Gambling and golf don't go too well together with billion-dollar losses in government bailouts, especially not in the form of a three-day junk at the Las Vegas. Last night, Goldman Sachs moved its annual technology conference from the Mandalay Bay Resort in Vegas to San Francisco. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
No offense, San Francisco, but Goldman Sachs thinks you're boring. Boring enough to pass muster with regulators and wary taxpayers whose cash is helping prop up the bank. Goldman also switched venues for a hedge fund conference from Miami to New York.
They're not resorts, and that's the big deal.
John Daly is a corporate events planner who works with Wall Street firms. He's giving the same advice to clients in the auto industry. Tone it down.
Even though they may have the same good time, you know, you go to New York, you can still do a lot of Broadway shows. It's not considered a resort where the average person is thinking about these guys laying out on a beach.
particularly not this time of year. Other banks are taking similar precautions. Last week, Wells Fargo canceled an employee retreat planned for Las Vegas. Morgan Stanley called off a similar trip to Monte Carlo. But in protecting its image, Goldman Sachs may end up hurting its business. The AP reports Goldman's on the hook for a hefty cancellation fee. And New York and San Francisco are some of the most expensive cities in the country. Tim Grisky is with Solaris Asset Management.
It's going to be an extra cost, certainly, for the company, which is ironic because companies are making these changes to avoid the perception that they are overspending.
Worse still, Goldman risks alienating some clients. They'll have to rebook travel for a conference in 2 weeks. The bank told them about the change yesterday. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Polls have closed in Israel, but today's election there is still really too close to call. It's going to come down to which of the major parties can put together a winning coalition over the next couple of days. Security was the very clear undercurrent during the campaign. Israel launched air and ground operations in Gaza last month in response to Hamas rocket attacks. The fighting took lives on both sides. In Gaza, it demolished homes and knocked out electrical systems. And reconstruction will inevitably be expensive. As it happens, the official currency in the Palestinian territories is the Israeli shekel. And Daniel Estrin reports now from Gaza that the shekel is really quite scarce.
Before I made my way from Jerusalem to Gaza, I stocked up on shekels. A shekel is worth about 25 cents. But that's often academic, because getting hold of shekels is very tough, as bank customer Khaled Abu Ghali found out on a recent visit to an ATM.
Okay, I will take 1,000 shekel. So my card is get out of the machine.
What does it say here on the screen?
It say here that there is no account in shekel. What you want to take, Jordanian dinars or dollar only.
So there's zero shekels here. You can't even take out five shekels.
Even one shekel. There isn't.
And this is the Arab Bank, the biggest bank in Gaza. Khaled Abu Ghali laughs it off. But at another bank nearby, in the manager's office upstairs, there's one account holder who's had it.
You close the door and say you don't have money, but this is my money. I'm going to sit here and wait until you give it to me.
The guy didn't even take a seat. He stormed off a few minutes later. Cash has been in short supply here since 2007. That's when the Islamist group Hamas forcibly took control of Gaza. Israel then imposed a strict blockade that limits trucks taking cash from bank headquarters in the West Bank to branches in Gaza. Israel, the U.S., and the EU consider Hamas a terrorist organization and don't want money getting into its hands. Over the last few months, the shekel embargo has tightened, and Gaza-based economist Khaled Abdel Shafi says banks are at rock bottom.
The problem is not only cash is not coming in, it's also people who usually deposit cash in the banks are not anymore doing that because they are afraid that if they deposit, they are not able to draw.
So Gazans today are putting their earnings everywhere else but in the hands of a bank teller. One taxi driver told me his wife sewed a secret pocket in his pillow to stash his cash. Others lock up their money in safe deposit boxes at the bank, which makes bank managers want to pull out their hair. Their bank is full of cash they can't touch. The familiar problem of no liquidity. And little cash is on hand for humanitarian aid groups. Oxfam's John Prideaux-Brune explains.
When we got to the bank, we were told that we were only allowed to withdraw 800 shekels. To complete the our program, we need 350,000 shekels.
That's not quite enough, is it?
No, it's nowhere near enough, because without cash, we just can't do it.
This is where the lack of cash begins to have more long-term implications on the rebuilding of Gaza. Again, economist Khaled Abdel Shafi.
If the cash problem is not resolved, it's nonsense to talk about reconstruction. How are you going to hire contractors and contractors are going to hire workers without cash?
UN workers recently brought cash into Gaza by car. It's a risky way to do business, and they just found out why. Last week, armed Hamas men stole hundreds of UN blankets and food aid. It's one more reason why Israel is hesitant to let in trucks full of cash. Until the cash shortage is resolved, says Abdel Shafi, The people of Gaza, desperate for homes and sewage systems to be restored, will pay a heavy price. In Gaza, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Coming up, cheap eats in bad times.
You're going to see increasingly as you go into your grocery store, you will see a lot of discussion of ham and cheese, grilled cheese, and a variety of the other simple ideas that consumers can eat that are economical in today's environment.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's been a while since we've had the wah-wah trombones. The Dow Industrials gave up 4.6% today, 381 points, closed at 7,888. NASDAQ tumbled 4.2%, 66 points, 1524 the number. The S&P 500 plowed down 4.9%. That is 42 points, 827 at the bell there. Financials, do I need to say it, really led the markets down. Bank of America thundered 19 points lower. Citigroup crumbled 15 points. J.P. Morgan withdrew nearly 10% today. Nobody got away with it. Boeing belly flopped 6%. ExxonMobil tanked 4%. General Electric blew out 8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.8%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for January. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for December. And a House committee focuses on food safety following the salmonella outbreak linked to peanuts. They'll talk about what went wrong and how to prevent it from happening in the future. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see what the opening of the Asian markets brings in a couple of hours. It's not unusual for an ugly day here to be followed by something similar there, and vice versa. Yet another reminder that the economy and this financial crisis is indeed global. There are buying opportunities, of course, for investors with the cash and the stomachs to jump in. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tsang reports that Chinese investors showed they have both in two big deals this week.
China holds $2 trillion in foreign reserves, and its companies have deep pockets, too. Today, the state-owned firm Chinalco said it's in intense talks to invest up to $20 billion in Rio Tinto. That's the global mining giant. A deal could come Thursday. Sean Ryan of China Market Research says Beijing's motivation is to secure commodities.
This highlights the demand for iron ore, aluminum, anything that can be used in construction materials. We also see that China is making great strides in trying to improve its access to oil.
Chinalco is already Rio's top shareholder, and upping its stake could trigger anti-China protectionism in Australia, where Rio is partly based. But political analyst Malcolm Cook says these days, beggars can't be, you know.
The mood in the country towards foreign investment might be less wary than it was last year when Australia was benefiting from the best trade since the Korean War, I think.
Chinalco wants a seat on Rio's board. It wants clout. So does Chinese insurance firm Ping An in a separate case. Ping An is the biggest investor in European bank Fortis. Fortis wants to sell off some assets, but the Chinese investor is opposed and it could sink tomorrow's shareholder vote. Financial consultant Michael McCormick says it should fail. Fortis is unloading its best assets.
It's a bit like someone telling you, yeah, I'm going to sell your apartment to somebody else, but you can keep this broken toaster.
Chinese investors once walked softly, but the more they invest, the more they want a voice to put their mouth where their money is. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott mentioned that China's got $2 trillion in foreign reserves. More than half of that is in U.S. dollars, treasury bills and the like. Combine that with a huge Chinese trade surplus with us, and it's not too hard to connect the dots between our economic recovery and theirs. During his confirmation hearings, Timothy Geithner made what a lot of people consider ill-timed remarks about Beijing and currency manipulation. He said the Chinese were manipulating it to get an economic advantage. Commentator Helen Popper hopes Geithner can think about the bigger picture.
Now that Timothy Geithner is our Treasury Secretary, it's time for him to set aside his provocative talk about China's currency practices. Sure, China's currency is weak, but dogging the Chinese about currency manipulation won't get us anywhere right now. Right now, we need an international effort to stimulate the world's economy. Stimulating just the U.S. economy isn't enough. Our stimulus will leak a little. That is, when the government pays Joe the paver, Joe might spend a little part of his money on a hockey stick from Canada. Imports like that help other economies, but weaken the stimulus's benefit to our own. We need countries to undertake their own big stimulus packages, ones that will leak a little in our direction. China has proposed a nice big package. It's nearly twice the size of ours relative to its economy. And the rest of the world's economic powerhouses have packages in the works. But follow-through is vital. If the packages are delayed, watered down, or worse, fail to get enacted at all, then prospects for a global recovery will fade. The Obama administration should support China's new stimulus package, encourage other countries, and move aggressively to coordinate these mutually reinforcing policies. The alternative is grim. Geithner's accusation of currency manipulation, justified or not, smacks of the mistakes of the Great Depression. Back then, each country relied on currency devaluations to spur its own economy at the expense of others. The devaluations went hand in hand with protectionism, and global trade and economic activity plummeted. U.S. trade fell from $10 billion in 1929 to only $3 billion in 1933, and U.S. livelihoods fell right along with it. In the current crisis, world trade has already moved down sharply, but trade is not a zero-sum game. We can all grow or shrink together. The lesson from the dark days of the Great Depression is that recovery requires a strategy of global cooperation, not mutual antagonism. Let's hope Geithner's currency talk was an unfortunate rhetorical holdover and not an omen of the new administration's policy.
Helen Popper is an associate professor of economics at Santa Clara University. You can send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There are obviously a lot of businesses that don't do so well in a down economy, but on the theory that everybody's got to eat, processed foods isn't a bad choice right now. As the recession grinds on, more people are swapping a night on the town for a trip to the grocery store. That's driving up revenues at companies like General Mills and Kellogg's and the world's biggest processed food company, Kraft. James Kraft started his business more than 100 years ago, selling door-to-door in Chicago. Today, Kraft has a number of billion-dollar brands like Oreos and Oscar Mayer. But the company that practically invented pasteurized processed cheese food is losing cheese market share to lower-priced competitors.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Kraft Foods CEO Irene Rosenfeld on how the company's trying to put the bounce back in its cheese business.
We have two very attractive forms of cheese that we make, Kraft Singles and products like Velveeta. We also make natural cheese, and increasingly we're finding that there's less opportunity to differentiate ourselves in that segment of the market.
Let me pick up on that for a second. My kids, for some reason, and maybe this is because of my wife and I don't know, but I grew up with Kraft Singles, right? I mean, that was just a staple around my house. My kids, though, have sort of just discovered them. How do you get something as iconic as Kraft Singles out into the marketplace so more consumers do it? I mean, what do you do as a marketer?
What you do is you pick up on the fact that it is the number one cheese used in making grilled cheese, which is one of America's favorite foods. And so we're finding, particularly in this difficult economic environment, there is nothing more exciting to a consumer than grilled cheese and a bowl of soup. And so we're able to benefit greatly from people's desire to return to economical delicious alternatives.
I understand marketing, but nothing more exciting than grilled cheese and a bowl of soup?
What are you going to have for lunch? If I told you I could serve you grilled cheese and a bowl of soup, wouldn't you be happy?
I love a good grilled cheese sandwich and a bowl of soup. But if I'm packing lunch for the kids in the morning, it's really tough to pack a grilled cheese sandwich for lunch for kids 7 hours later.
No, it works just fine. You stick it right in the microwave, and it tastes just delicious.
You have a PhD in marketing and statistics. So I'm going to guess you're fluent in how to get the message out and the numbers behind that message. So help me, walk me through how you go about reframing some of these brands that you have, Oreos or Kraft Singles. How do you do that?
Well, Kai, very simply, it starts with a deep understanding of consumer behavior and how these products fit into their lives. And I think we've learned a lot. I mean, that's why, for example, as we think about brands like Kraft Singles, it's not about what we've done to the cheese slice itself, but rather about what it means to a consumer. And to a consumer, Kraft Singles is about making a grilled cheese sandwich.
I get that you're pushing grilled cheese sandwiches with Kraft Singles. Why not a ham and cheese sandwich? What made you in the marketing meeting say, it's got to be grilled cheese?
Well, actually, you've hit on another one of our important opportunities, which is sandwiches in general.
See, I think you should have gone with the ham and cheese instead of the grilled cheese, and that way you can get Oscar Mayer and Kraft Singles in there.
Well, I think you're going to see increasingly as you go into your grocery store, you will see a lot of discussion of ham and cheese, grilled cheese, and a variety of the other simple ideas that consumers can eat that are economical in today's environment.
And those are all conscious efforts on your part when you sit and you run these marketing meetings.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The sandwich is back.
The Kraft sandwich is back, right? I mean, let's put that on the table.
When the sandwich is back, it's got
it's
Kraft inside.
Kraft.
I'm confident about that.
Let me ask you a branding question again, and I hate to keep bringing my kids up, but my kids know all the words to the Oscar Mayer song. My baloney has a first name, that one, right? Okay. They don't know, though, that it's a Kraft product. Is that a problem for you?
As long as they know it's an Oscar Mayer product, I'm perfectly comfortable.
You all right with that?
Yeah. This is not we make many products. In fact, there are so many products that we make. Maxwell House Coffee, for example, consumers would not know our Kraft products. As long as they can sing Oscar Mayer, I'm perfectly comfortable.
They do incessantly. When you go food shopping for your groceries, are you able to just shop, or do you bring Irene Rosenfeld, the CEO of Kraft Foods, with you and you're analyzing market share and shelf placement and all that analytical stuff you have to do?
I absolutely bring Irene Rosenfeld, the CEO, with me. My family hates shopping.
I was just going to say, that's so not fun, right?
I straighten all the shelves. I look at our out-of-stocks. In fact, my selling organization is always intrigued to know where I live so they can, they can fix the shelves.
I bet. Irene Rosenfeld, the chairman and CEO of Kraft Foods. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I was hoping she'd sing with me. She wasn't having any of it. For more of my conversation with Irene Rosenfeld and conversations from other corner offices, the archives are on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which gives a whole new meaning to the phrase playing the lottery. For years, the New York State Lottery parked its payout money in Treasury bonds, $1.3 billion in ultra-safe but not very profitable treasuries. Bloomberg News reported this morning state officials want better returns so the lottery can add more to the state treasury. So they have decided, get this, to start playing the stock market. The legislature does still have to buy off on the plan. The lottery is looking for an 8% annual rate of return on its payout pool. Counting today, so far this year, the Dow is off more than 10%. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 381 points, 4.6%. The NASDAQ down 66 points, 4.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 42 points. That is 4.9% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, even job seekers with skills are still looking for work.
Layoff indicates you'll possibly come back. But that's not an option.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.